Hello, Carrington.
Hello, Kevin.
I'm sad, Carrington.
Why are you sad? Why are you a sad Kevin?
Because Kansas Fest is over.
Oh, but only for now.
Only for now.
Yes. There will be more Kansas Fest.
We are still technically at Kansas Fest, but everything is packed up, and we are about to depart and go away.
And that is why this is another very special episode of Eaten by a Groot, for certain definitions of special.
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
So what is this that people are about to hear?
Well, we gave a talk the other day.
We did. It was a huge success.
It was.
For certain definitions of success.
Making a note here. Huge success.
And what was our talk about?
It was about Infocom's, it was called Infocom's Non-Interactive Nonfiction.
That's right. We talked about books and comics and games and a database that killed the company.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And people are about to hear it, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Where can they hear it?
We're going to hear it.
Right here, right now.
Right now.
Okay, let's get into our next session. We have Mr. Vanston and Mr. Savitz talking about Infocom's non-interactive nonfiction. And take it away.
Good morning, Kansas Fest.
Good morning, Kansas Fest.
So yeah, Infocom is of course known for its interactive fiction games, but they spent their entire time in existence trying to create other things, putting out feelers and trying new projects, and it was, you know, trying to be it was a very innovative company. Many of these things did not succeed, but they were made the attempt. So this is our look, and I didn't start the recording here. This is our look into the other things other than interactive fiction that Infocom did. So, we're going to start with the Info Comics. These were comic books that you could play on your computer. Now, we're not doing any of this chronologically, it's just we grouped them in the things that make sense to us. So this was actually pretty late in the Infocom timeline, but they put out a set of four comic books that you would play on the computer. This was something that was available for the Apple II, and the kind of the hook was you could go through the comic, see the story, and then at the end of it, you could go back and do it again from a different character's perspective. So you can find out why that character did what he did, find out about their emotions and their separate timeline. So so here's a couple of the covers. They were going for very pulpy, you know, 1950s comic book sort of style here. Here's the other two. These first two were kind of their own. Lane Mastodon versus the Blubbermen and Gamma Force, Pit of a Thousand Screams, very 1950s. And then they had two that were kind of tied into the Zork universe a little bit. Zork Quest, Assault on Ygritte Castle, and the Zork Quest, The Crystal of Doom. Doom, I tell you. Here are some screenshots from various games that I pulled. Very colorful, depending on the platform, and nice little stories. And again, the neat part was that it wasn't just one and done. You could go back and do it a few times and see the stories. Stole this quote about them from Questor's Log website. It said, "What was really cool about these was that the player was able to make their way through the fairly basic tale from the unique perspective of each character before reaching the story's climax, which allowed us to see the character's motivations, fears, triumphs, and so forth in a way we would not have been able to otherwise." Now, interesting that these games were outsourced, they were produced by Tom Snyder Productions, which is probably not a company that you've heard of, but they did a bunch of stuff that you have heard of. This was a software publisher that did was huge in the educational software market. They did Agent USA and Banner Catch for Scholastic, Haley Project for Mindscape, Run for the Money for Scarborough Systems, and In Search of the Most Amazing Thing, and Snooper Troops 1 and 2 for Spinnaker. I recently interviewed this guy. I don't think this the Tom Snyder. I don't believe it's been published yet on the Antic podcast. And we didn't talk about this at all, but... yeah, so, you know, it's not schlocky stuff. I mean the stories are, I think, meant to be a little schlocky, but it wasn't poorly done. Carrington.
Hello, I'm Carrington.
Watch out for the frostbite.
So, I am going to talk about a different sort of book that they did. And we're going to start with the kind of books that are accounting. So I think it's important, if you think about the things that Infocom was doing that wasn't in their wheelhouse, that weren't their text adventures, you have to keep in the context of what was happening with their sales. And we're going to look at their sales in a series of charts. I couldn't find piles of money, so we're going to do mounds of dirt instead. So 1982, they had this much money coming in. By 83, mound of dirt was much larger. 84 was a mountain. 85... began a different trend, and that crater just got smaller. So this is the context we have to keep in mind. So they decided to do something other than the interactive fiction games that they're most known for, and they said, well, let's try something different that's related to what we were doing before. And here we have one of their choose-your-own-adventure games. They put out a series of these books. There's four of them. Now, this is a doctored image. That's not exactly what the book looked like. We'll zoom in on the doctored bit, because they were not called Choose Your Own Adventure books, because there already were Choose Your Own Adventure books called Choose Your Own Adventure books. So they had to come up with a different name. What they came up with was What Do I Do Now books, which I think is perfect for Infocom, because that completely encapsulates that feeling we all have when you're playing a text adventure and you want to throw your computer against the wall. That's a perfect name. So they came up with What Do I Do Now books. There were four of them in the series. There was The Forces of Krill, The Malefestro Quest, The Cavern of Doom, and Conquest at Quendor. They came out in 83 and 84. So we all remember how the mounds of dirt were big and huge in 83 and 84. That's the context of these books. So they're trying other things, but there's no desperation involved. These were all written by Steve Moretzky, and they all had something in common, exactly. So they're all in the world of Zork, and they're all written by Steve Moretzky. He was one of the imps that had written a bunch of their best and best-selling games. He did Planetfall and Sorcerer and Mind Forever Voyaging, Leather Goddesses of Phobos, which, if you don't know, Infocom Games was an actual title, and he co-wrote, but mostly actually wrote, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game for Hitchhiker. So real pedigree here, and these books are by him. Unlike the Infocom text adventures, these are written in the third person, so you're following Bill and June, two kids that get magically transported to the world of Zork. But like a typical Choose Your Adventure book, you're basically following a path through the book. And this is the path that you follow through the first book. You see how there's the choices. You get to the end of a page, it says, do you want to go left, you want to go right, you want to use the wand or not use the wand, and it follows through. There is one path that takes you to a win. Everything else is a horrible loss. One thing that's different about these than Choose Your Own trademark books is you get a score at the end. So if you get through to a certain ending, it'll say your score was 4 out of 10. It also lets you go back. We all know that when you use a Choose Your Own Adventure book, you stick your thumb in to remember your place. That just does it for you. And so you'll get to this end, they'll say, oh, you made a poor choice, you're dead, your score is 6 out of 10. Would you like to go back and try something else? If so, turn back to page 72. So it remembers the branch you came from. So that's kind of a cool addition. They released one of these books, the third one in the series, for some reason, was many years later, released for free, and you can play it online. And this is one of the places I found that you can play it online. You can either write that down, or really, if you just search for Play Zork Game Book Online, you'll find a bunch of sources for it. We reuse this slide because we're going to look at really quickly at another sort of book they came up with. Later on, so in the late 80s, starting in 1988, so we remember where we are in dirt and crater time, they came out with a series of novels. There's six novels written by a bunch of people. There's Wishbringer, Enchanter, Planetfall, Stationfall, Zork Chronicles, and Lost City of Zork. The first four books really are companion pieces to the games of the same names. They are not they're not novelizations of the game, but rather, if you look at like the first Planetfall book, there is basically a sequel to the game, but just written as straight novels. They're not interactive. The Chronicles book is about the adventure of a hero named Miracles, but spelled with a K, like a rapper. And the Lost City book is about the origin of the world of Zork and the Great Underground Empire. And in case you are wondering if these books for you, I will say that the Lost Empire book features a winged vampire were-unicorn. There's no picture of that in the book, but the internet was willing to give me this. So that is essentially what you can look forward to if you look at these books. And they're actually relatively well-reviewed, but they're a symbol of the kind of things they were just throwing out there to try to start digging themselves out of the big crater hole. So now we're going to turn to my co-host.
I'm over here.
Oh, I'm going to say who's left.
I'm the presentation. I'm enjoying myself.
No, to look at other things.
Other things.
Another thing they tried was to create a board game called Fublitsky. If you were here at Kansas Fest last year, or even this year, it's still here, we played the game Fublitsky last year that Carrington brought. We had a pretty good time. It's actually a good game. It's still here if you want to play it tonight or tomorrow. It's in the lobby for anybody to play. So this is a board game with an actual with pieces with software for your Apple computer. I believe it was also available for the IBM. And in it, there are up to four players who play little dogs who go around the town trying to collect things. It's basically a treasure hunt. It's a lot like some sort of treasure hunting game where you look for things. It's like perhaps Clue, where you have to go from place to place, get information, and kind of deduce the things that you need, MacGuffins that you're MacGuffining. So, you know, Infocom was always trying to fighting against piracy, and this was one of the best ways they could do that. But you could absolutely not play this game without the stuff, you know. So you needed the box and the board and the pens and all the things to write on and such. So it was kind of an interesting, feely, browsy package that you absolutely couldn't play it without buying it, which is interesting because nobody bought it. Nobody bought this game. Here's some beautiful screenshots from various versions of Fublitsky. Fun animation, nice graphics, very cartoony. Requires absolutely no reading. It's all pretty intuitive. It's just like a little picture of a joystick, you know, when you have to press the button, that sort of thing. All iconography, all pictures. Here's the New York Times newsletter when they announced Fublitsky, a unique graphics strategy game. It was released in summer 1985. So let's talk about Fublitsky's financial deal. Like I said, it was released in summer 1985, and oddly, it was only available to people on the New York Times mailing list for 6 months. The only way to get it was to buy it directly from them, and I believe at the time it cost $39.95, and by winter 1986, it still cost $39.95 when it had general release to software stores, that sort of thing. No one was buying it. Nobody bought this thing. And by summer 1987, it was $14.95, a classic title. And by June 1987, it was less than $10. Nobody understood it. I think that, you know, people expected a certain thing from Infocom, and they were there for Interactive Fiction, and while this thing might have been fun, it was coming perhaps from the wrong publisher. People just
didn't have any friends, that's why I didn't buy it.
Yes, and also you needed friends, right. Yeah, this was, right. So, let's talk about how well it sold. In 1985, Fublitsky sold 500 copies. In 1986, it sold 1,700 for a total of a little more than 8,000. By the fiscal year 89, it had sold negative 714. That year they had more returns than sales on that game. So it's a fairly rare game. Next we're going to talk about Cornerstone. a sophisticated database manager for non-programmers. Cornerstone was also the ninth studio album put out by Styx. It was a follow-up to two albums that had hit the top 20. And it was recorded in Illinois at Pumpkin Studios.
He's doing this for me, because I was that's what we should talk about.
So...
No, please go on.
Didn't you have another section? Wasn't that supposed to be in here?
Where's
your section?
Slide,
I don't know. Let's go. Okay, let's switch back to your thing.
Do you not
have my slides? Of course, I'll get in there. Here's your
That's
stuff.
That's me!
Oh, I see. I had one. All right. Look, we're professionals. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Cornerstone will be coming. Uh-huh.
Research Styx. Cast your mind back. Farther back. Too far back. Here's where we are. So, get you in the mindset. We're now going to talk about the game Journey. Not the band Journey, although Journey and Styx could have been this entire, I was going to say podcast, this entire presentation. Breakfast Club. 1985 is the mindset. So we remember the hills, right? Where we are. 1985. So, at this point, Infocom is divided into basically two camps. One camp wants to stick with text adventures, but add graphics and sound, because that kind of stuff is coming out and it's beginning to eat their lunch. One camp wants to give up on that stuff and do other things. We have to try new stuff. We have to go a totally different way. It's in this context that the game Journey gets released. The game was by Mark Blank, another one of Infocom's implementers, who was particularly good at the tech side of things. He pushed the envelope with the parser early on, and here he is pushing it again, trying to push forward and change what an Infocom game can mean. But the camp that wants to do something different doesn't want to leave behind the main thing that the text parser gives you, which is that depth and variety of storytelling. Like, Infocom is a storytelling company, and so they want to still offer that. They just want to try to offer it in other ways. One of the focuses is to not be a typing game anymore, because there's these things that are coming out, like the Nintendo system has just been released and it's going to start eating everybody's lunch. And what about that amazing Philips CDI? That'll probably be huge. So there's going to be a lot of game platforms that are not keyboard based, and that's going to leave you high and dry if you're a text company. So one of the ideas is, how can we make games that were great on a computer but can compete in a world where there aren't necessarily going to be game playing keyboards? What do we do if we don't want to do just like a point-and-click adventure, because that doesn't give us the storytelling and the depth of choice and interactivity that we want? So one idea was to bridge these things and do a storytelling text-based game, but instead of typing, you will click on stuff. And so that's what's happening here. So that's how Journey gets born. So we have a graphical adventure, lots of text still, lots of story, but these beautiful graphics. And in a very token-esque, like this really wants to be a token thing. So on the bottom there, you can see there in the screenshot, there's a list of the party members. Tag, the one at the very bottom, is the hero of this story. He's the one telling what they call the chronicle in this game. And rather than typing your commands, you click on people and then click on a verb, click on something that modifies the verb, and then say click on a target. So in this case, what you see is somebody has clicked on the verb cast. Somebody's going to cast something, then they pick the elevation. So casting elevation at, and at this point, you're going to pick a target. Who are we going to elevate? Who are we going to levitate? So we have to remember, because one of the goals here was to target things like gaming systems instead of typing on the old parser. So that's a really important thing. And it's still giving us that depth of story and puzzle telling, and puzzle solving and storytelling, and so that's really important. And to give us these amazing graphics. So another advantage, a thing they were really trying to target, going for broad audience, is something where it's very difficult to die. Like, really, there aren't going to be any major negative endings. And it's very easy to navigate this, so it's a very accessible game. Except, this is none of those things. If you get good more than halfway through this, you start having to type stuff into a command line. I don't understand. Like, you play through the game, and you click, 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 and by the way, here's a command line, start typing. That's an interesting implementation if your target is things that don't have keyboards. Also, while technically there's very few ways to die in this game, there's a ton of ways to simply run out of things to do. And I guess they considered that not really dying. So you cast spells here by using regents. And the regents are components that you cast a spell. And you'll have storytelling, you'll have puzzles, you can encounter a puzzle, and you can solve it in multiple ways. Pick a spell. The spell will use up a regent. Hope you pick the right spell, because maybe you'll need that regent later in the game. Another hour, another day, a month from now, you get to the point where you've just run out of stuff to do because you used that regent way before. Too bad, start the game again. So that's an interesting mix of having these clear targets, but kind of fumbling it, which is what Infocom did a lot in the late half of the 80s when they're on that creator slide. It's still, though, an example of Infocom sticking in their wheelhouse and trying something new. Well, this game isn't necessarily a success by a lot of metrics. It still is Infocom being Infocom. It's Infocom telling a story. They're trying to say, what can we do, still be Infocom, and maybe game into the 90s. It wasn't successful, but at least this is an example of something they did different that had, I think, laudable goals. They just fumbled the ball.
What platform is that screenshot?
This is from not the Apple II version. I couldn't find it. This is, I think, from the PC version. It was released for Apple II, though. This is one of the games that released for a bunch of platforms, including the Apple II. Then we come to Quarterstaff. That's another one I'm going to talk about briefly. So Journey either is or is not Infocom's first RPG game. Because it had all those RPG elements. You've got multiple characters and things they can do and abilities and stuff. So it's very much an RPG game, but also a text adventure. We have Quarterstaff, which Infocom bills as their first text adventure, or as their first RPG. And it depends, whether that's true or not, depends on a few things. One, whether or not you consider Journey an RPG. And two, whether or not you consider Infocom to even, or Quarterstaff to even be an Infocom game. So Quarterstaff, or to give it its full name, Quarterstaff, the Tomb of Setmoth, was released by Infocom for the Macintosh in 1988. So we all remember where we are now in 1988, how deep that crater started getting. And so this comes out the year before Journey. It's a much more traditional RPG. It's got adventures and monsters and spells and stats and stuff. It's basically trying to emulate the pen and paper RPG stuff. So that's very different than the text adventures they did before. It's a complete departure now. It does things, even all the little tedious bits, like keeping track of your fatigue and how much you're carrying and all the stuff that nobody actually really likes from the pen and paper stuff. It was lauded as having a great enemy AI, including creatures that can like learn from their mistakes. It got a 5-star review in Dragon. Like, things were awesome. You could even split the party, but you should never split the party. So one of the big features that Infocom promoted, I'm going to read you a quote here, because this was a Mac program, and although not their first Mac program, but in the status line for fall 1988, Infocom proudly proclaimed the following. It has pull-down menus to actually allow you to easily point and click your way through even complex sentences. We've included Apple's hierarchical menus, usually found only in top-notch business products. That was one of their big pushes for this game. You've got hierarchical menus, which sounds like a great idea, right? How would you like to have to do that for every sentence? Although it was a Mac game, the one thing they did right, though, is you can actually play this game completely from the keyboard, because Infocom is very much still a keyboard-oriented company. So this clearly is an RPG game, and it clearly came before Journey. So why would I think, well, maybe this isn't Infocom's first RPG game? Because this wasn't made by Infocom. So here we're beginning to get into this era where Infocom is publishing other people's stuff. And it isn't just that somebody else made the game and Infocom published it. Somebody else wrote the game, created the game, published the game, and released the game all before Infocom got involved. So what happened was a company called Simulated Environmental Systems made this version of the game. They made it first, the year before Infocom. 1987, they create and release this game. Fully released, advertised, everything. It's out there as a box. The release was really well reviewed. It also got a 5-star review in Dragon, which seemed to give a 5-star review to everything back then. So what happened? Lack of money. Like, everybody's got a creator.
The microphone is cutting out.
Oh, is it?
And it doesn't like pockets.
And we don't know how to fix it. Hit your pocket, maybe. I don't know.
I can be louder.
Well, yeah.
Sure enough, I can be louder.
We know that already.
They ran out of money, and they could only do a limited release of this game. So it came out in just limited release, and it did have problems. There were, for instance, a bunch of bugs that made it impossible to finish the game. But Infocom looked at this and said, "There's a lot of stuff here that's like what we would like to do, and maybe this is the kind of game we'd like to make. And it would be much faster to simply buy that game. It doesn't matter that it's already released." So they buy up the game, bring it back into Infocom, and then make a bunch of changes to it. So they have Amy Briggs, who had written an Infocom game before.
before, Plundered Hearts. She does a rewrite on the text and tweaks all the plot. They have a bunch of graphics people and editors give the game a big polish. They add a bunch of feelies like they did into the package. And they put in what? A parchment called The Path to Enlightenment, a wooden druid coin, and a big poster. And then sent the game back out again in 1988, now as an Infocom title. It actually has a cult following. The revised version is one you can actually complete. And although Infocom, so they had announced they were going to release that game then for the Apple IIgs, but they never did. So we'll very quickly look at now a couple of other things. BattleTech. We're back into this idea of games that are they Infocom? Like they've got Infocom on the box, but it's a different sort of thing. So Westwood Studios made the BattleTech game, but unlike when we're looking at Quarterstaff, which is a company makes a game, releases it, has a bunch of problems, Infocom says, hey, let's do a do-over. They're contracted to make the game. The idea is from the beginning this will be an Infocom game, but it's not being made by Infocom, and it's very different than the stuff you'd be used to. So Westwood would go on to develop a whole bunch of very successful titles in the 90s. Like they're the guys behind Command & Conquer. And they basically created the real-time strategy genre, I think with Dune 2, which came out in the early 90s. This is their first game for Infocom, this one, which is really the game that put them on the map as a studio, because this comes out in 1988, so we're deep into Dirt Crater time for Infocom. Over half the staff by this point at Infocom has been laid off. They've been bought, they're sold to Activision in a fire sale. It's a very different company, but it still is Infocom at its heart. But this game is just produced by another company and then published by Infocom. And it's, a major departure for what you'd think an Infocom game would look like. It looks like this. It's a graphical game. It's a strategy war game. The goal in the game is to pilot a three-story mech. And I would presume there's plot, but really, come on, you come for the mech, you stay for the destruction. Just go walk around and destroy all the things. a second BattleTech game was developed by Westwood, and it was a sequel, BattleTech: The Crescent Hawk's Revenge. Basically the same deal, walk around and destroy stuff. That one was released only for the PC, though. The first one, and this is a screenshot from the Apple II version, whole bunch of platforms, including the Apple II. Second one, just for the PC. Second one comes out in 1990. So in a lot of ways, the BattleTech games kind of straddle the death point of Infocom. So the first one is released in the late 80s. It's essentially commissioned by Infocom, but it had a different look than a typical Infocom game, different mechanics, a totally different developer. There's not much Infocom in that Infocom game, but at least the Infocom on the label is referring to the company we all think of. Like, it is still at its heart that same thing. By the time of the second BattleTech game, then, which is also by Westwood, the Infocom on the label is really just the words Infocom on the label. It's got nothing really to do with the Infocom before. So it's not that BattleTech was the last Infocom game, but the two of them as a pair kind of are an archway over the death of Infocom. And super, super, super quickly, we'll just look at the covers of a couple things. Other games that really had the same thing going for them. A different company makes them and Infocom puts them out. We have Minds of Titan, which was released in 1989. Looks like this, also developed by Westwood, so same sort of deal. Let's get another company to create a thing, we put it out, different sort of game, Infocom's on the cover. It was a single player RPG, but it was released for the Apple II. They also did Circuit's Edge. Now Circuit's Edge was also developed by Westwood, but just published by Activision with Infocom on the title. And in this case, it's one from 1990. It's essentially a game that has nothing at all to do with Infocom, even the people that would have been at Infocom. It just happens to have Infocom on the box. And this is a hybrid text adventure and RPG, so it's kind of Infocom's wheelhouse in that way, but nothing to do with the company. And it's based on a book called When Gravity Fails, which was the first book in a series. So I think the thinking was, if this game's successful, it could be a series of games. It was not successful, and there is no series of games. But you can see how Infocom goes from doing a text adventure, producing and developing and publishing company, to being just a publishing company, to being just a name on a label. And that's the arc. We go from dirt to crater. And now, more. What happened? What made this crater? What contributed?
Tell us. I will tell you what made this crater, Carrington. Sticks. Quarterstone was the ninth album released by Styx. It was done at Pumpkin Studios, and it was a follow-up to two top 20 albums. They had a lot writing on this. They really did.
Do you go on?
It was also a database manager. Infocom wanted to get into business products.
they created a business products unit. They were running their own business, and they started creating software to run it, and they were always reaching out to find new lines to get into. They knew interactive fiction wasn't going to last forever. They knew, they saw the graphics cards, they saw games with sound, and they didn't want to, they wanted more legs on their stool. So it was time for Cornerstone. Developing Cornerstone, we've tried at every step to anticipate what a sane or insane person might attempt to do next. There's a critical difference between Cornerstone and the games. While the games strive to make life more difficult, constantly thwarting your best efforts, posing enigmas, even leaving you dead in some remote wasteland, in Cornerstone, we've done everything we can to make things easy. You'll never need InvisiClose to use Cornerstone because we've given it a help key.
Wow.
It was generally well reviewed for a new business product. However, keep in mind, at the same time, SQL was also starting to appear. And what was another one? DBase was starting to appear. And Cornerstone was good, but was not from a business company and could not really hold a candle to what those other things could do. Here's a certificate of birth that was sent around as a memo at Infocom. Child's name, Cornerstone. Parents' name, Infocom. Date of birth, January 31st, 1985. Attending physician, business products. A gala birthday party has been planned for Cornerstone on Thursday, January 31st, 1985. Festivities start at 5 with refreshments to be served starting at 6. Second floor here at Infocom. Don't miss a celebration of Infocom's newest family member. A good times guarantee for all. And at one point, it did beat out DBase 2 on the sales charts. They the number one, let's see, when was this? Actually, this was undated, but at this time, Hitchhiker's Guide was number one in entertainment, and Wishbringer was number 3, and Cornerstone was number 27 in business, beating out DBase 2 at 28. And there was a party for that, too. I think there were just a lot of parties when you worked at Infocom. It was on the soft sell hot list. So let's do some timeline. I started in October 82, and the thing wasn't released until January 85. They worked on this product for a long time, and it took a lot of resources. Cornerstone is generally accused as the thing that killed Infocom. And that's a complicated truth. A lot of things contributed to the death of Infocom. But Cornerstone was one of those things. It was a sink of time and a sink of financial resources. They created this business products unit, and it ended up failing. Had they taken those resources and put them into something else that did not fail, then yes, Infocom might have survived a lot longer. Did Cornerstone specifically kill the company? No, but they gambled on the wrong horse, for sure, and that had a lot to do with it. So October 1982, the Business Products Division was founded, and they started working on Cornerstone. And it was announced in 84. It was released in 85 for $495. In September 85, Mind Forever Voyaging was released, and they started doing layoffs due to Cornerstone's commercial failure. And a few months later, in February 86, Ballyhoo was released. So they're still putting out good stuff. I mean, the info on the text adventure side, man, they're still killing it with Mind Forever Voyage and Ballyhoo. I mean, this is like their peak game. February 86, Ballyhoo comes out, but Cornerstone is now one-fifth the price at $99.95. And then by June of that year, Activision buys Infocom for a penny for nothing. The Digital Antiquarian says Infocom could likely have survived if they had avoided Cornerstone and made smart business decisions, and the world of gaming would doubtless have been a better place for their tradition of literacy, thoughtfulness, and innovation. Oh, I guess that's it. Do we have any more, Carrie Jen? Any summarying up? Infocom was a great company that did great things, and I think that it really comes down to they did one thing very well. They tried to find other things to do well, and they put their paintbrush into a lot of pots, and nothing else really stuck, and that's why we have no Infocom today.
Boo. Atari. Anybody have any questions?
Well, you probably covered it before I came in. There's two questions. One, what platform did it run on? And
did what run on?
Did their Infocom, I guess it's different programs, must have run on different platforms.
Yes.
And two, do we ever see Infocom alumni at KFest?
Question one, what platforms did they run on? So the games were made with an amazing sort of virtual machine that the text adventure games could run on anything from a deck PDP through PCs down to you can run them on a current modern Mac because all you need is a simple lightweight virtual machine. As far as the other stuff, like Cornerstone was just a PC product, and then some of the RPGs and things were...
like Mac and then PC.
Mac and PC.
And then just PC.
Yeah. So it really varied. But for it depended on the era, the time.
A lot of them.
And have any Infocom alumnus been here? Not that I know of. But
no, I don't think so.
They are welcome.
Very much so.
But they ran on the Apple too, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
So Cornerstone... was not for any Apple product.
Cornerstone was not for any Apple product.
PC,
it was PC only, because that's your business machine.
Do you know anything at all about like what's under the hood? Like, is it just sort of like indexed sequential files with a UI or
What's under the hood? No, I don't know. I haven't reviewed that yet for the Eaten by a Guru podcast.
Any else? We're good. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was quite a talk we gave.
That was amazing. It feels like it's been 20 seconds since we recorded the intro. But that was awesome. And thank you for podcasting with me, Kevin.
Thank you for podcasting with me.
And thank you, dear listener, for listening to us. If you have feedback about this or any of the episodes, even the not-so-special ones, you can send us email at gru, that's G-R-U-E, at monsterfeet.com. Show notes and such can be found at monsterfeet.com/group. If you want to contact us directly, you can will hear you.
Burp.
You can hit us up on Twitter. He is at Kevin Savitz. I am at Carrington, and we will see you next show.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, no. You have walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking group.